Today is Monday, October 4th, 2010. I'm Andrew Longhurst.
And I'm Jess Landing.
And this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Good evening. It's 5:02 and time for a full hour of independent news. Today we'll bring you a live interview with Megan Vies-Dunbar, board member of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, to discuss the Ontario court ruling that found the criminal code prohibitions on sex work are unconstitutional and the BCCLA's call on BC to abide by the ruling and reform employment law accordingly. That's in the first half of the show.
And later in the show, we'll be bringing you an interview with Thomas Woodley, President of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. News 101 spoke earlier this afternoon with him about the United Nations Human Rights Council's report on Israel's May 31st flotilla raid. The UN Human Rights Council found Israel's actions in violation of international law. And in our weekly feature with the Tai'i.ca, we will be speaking with Katie Hislop, the online news magazine's education reporter, about an upcoming series she is working on.
All this, plus your arts report and weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. At least three people died along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border today when dozens of NATO fuel tankers were torched. It's the third time supply trucks have been attacked since Thursday when Pakistan closed the main border crossing along the Khyber Pass. The closure was in response to NATO cross-border helicopter attacks last week. Taliban militants claimed responsibility for today's attack. In southwestern Pakistan, two other supply trucks were also attacked, and drone attacks continued today as well. Seven people died when unpiloted craft dropped two missiles in the tribal areas. Over the weekend, another 16 people were killed by drones in the same region. And in Afghanistan, a family died Saturday when a roadside bomb exploded in the southeast. Three of the seven civilians killed were children. And the same day, in Helmand Province, NATO and ISAF killed 20 people. According to local authorities, three of them were civilians. Brazilians hit the polls yesterday to vote for a new president. Workers' Party candidate Dilma Rousseff beat out her challengers, but fell just short of the 50% of votes needed to win in the first round. Mike Fox has more from Sao Paulo.
Yesterday's voting was generally quick, easy, and without any major incidents. Nevertheless, Brazilians will have to wait another month to find out who will be their next president. The big surprise yesterday was Green Party candidate Marina Silva, who won an impressive 20% of the vote, pushing the election into the second round. The big question now is whether she will throw her weight behind Dilma Rousseff or candidate José Serra later this month. If elected, Dilma would be Brazil's first female president. On the issue of abortion, she has said that she would like to hold a referendum to ask the Brazilian people if they support the legalization of abortion. She herself says she only supports it in extreme cases. More than 22,000 candidates also competed yesterday for Brazil's state governorships and seats in the Brazilian Congress, the Senate, and state legislatures. Both the Workers' Party and their allies, the Democratic Movement Party, were the big winners in the Senate and the Congress, although it is still too early to tell if they will have a majority. The second round of the elections is set for October 31st. Mike Fox, FSRN, Sao Paulo, Brazil.
California's Supreme Court ruled today that the state can force more than 200,000 employees to take time off without pay. Governor Schwarzenegger implemented furloughs to deal with dramatic budget deficits. The move costs state employees 14% of their pay. After a police insurrection that left 8 people dead and 193 injured, Ecuador's policy minister says that President Correa will not dissolve Congress. Sofia Harin reports from Quito.
3 days after the police insurrection in Ecuador, there is peace and quiet on the streets, but not so in the political sphere, where accusations fly about what happened last Thursday in this South American nation. The police went on a one-day national strike to protest the law of public service that would have canceled some bonuses and benefits. Interior Minister Gustavo Hackel said in declarations that the police insurrection was indeed a conspiracy to topple President Rafael Correa. However, there are several congresspeople who accuse the executive of trying to capitalize politically on a situation that got out of control. Many point out to an incendiary speech that the president gave at the police national headquarters hours after the insurrection had begun. Sofia Jarrín, FSRN, Quito, Ecuador.
Yesterday, an Israeli court convicted two Israeli soldiers of using a 9-year-old child as a human shield during the 2009 Gaza War. Rami Almagari has more.
On January 14, 2009, the building in the Tel Hawa neighborhood where Majid lives was attacked by Israeli soldiers. The family recalls that the soldiers rounded up women and children in the basement. Two of the soldiers ordered Majid to inspect two bags that they suspected were booby-trapped. Majid opened one bag. Then the soldiers ordered him to open a second.
They grabbed me and I wet myself. They ordered me to open the bag, but I didn't understand them. They pointed at the bag, but I couldn't open it. Then a soldier slammed me in the face and opened fire on the bag itself.
Now, almost 12 years old, Majid says he is glad for the court ruling and hopes that he and the children of Gaza will live in peace. The Israeli soldiers could face up to 3 years in prison. The guilty verdicts are the first substantial action against Israeli soldiers over incidents during the Gaza War. Rami Almighari, FSRN, Gaza.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
And as always, thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. And you can find their full newscast, their daily full newscast online at fsrn.org, as well as those 5-minute headlines. Now we go to our weekly feature with the Tai.ca, the online news magazine reaching all corners of British Columbia and beyond. And I'm joined on the line with Katie Hislop. Katie, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and I understand you are the new education reporter at the Tai.ca, and you're working on a series. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're working on?
Well, it's not so much a series, but I'm sort of like a hub based on education for K to 12 in British Columbia.
Okay.
So looking at issues surrounding educating children in our province. So.
And maybe tell me a little bit about your background and why you came to the Tai. It's always interesting to talk to journalists and learn a little bit about their background and why they were attracted to working at the Tai.
Well, actually, David Beers was one of my professors at journalism school. I just graduated from UBC's Masters of Journalism program in May.
Okay.
So he contacted me in August. I was actually back home in Newfoundland, and asked me if I was interested in doing some work. They were thinking of, they had an education reporter previously a couple of years ago, but she had to stop working, and they hadn't really done much with it since, so they wanted to develop sort of a hub based around education issues in the province, and he asked me if I would be interested in taking it on, and I definitely was, so I flew all the way back out here, and yeah, here I am.
Wonderful. Well, we're glad to have you on the show and glad to have you back in BC. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the issues that you're really interested in and look forward to investigating further?
Well, the major thing facing schools in British Columbia right now is what teachers and school boards are calling provincial underfunding. So underfunding from the Ministry of Education. Most school boards are facing budget shortfalls in the millions, some the multi-millions. Langley, in particular, actually doesn't only have a budget shortfall, but they have a debt of $13.5 million. So in a lot of cases, it's resulting in schools getting closed, teachers' jobs getting cut. So children are overcrowded in schools, bust out, their programs are cut, and inevitably children are going to fall through the cracks, particularly ones facing learning difficulties. Maybe their parents can't be as supportive because they work two jobs or they're just not around at the time. So, yeah, the biggest thing facing schools in BC right now is the lack of money, and I'm really interested in how that's going to affect kids, particularly the more vulnerable ones.
As many of our listeners, I'm sure, are aware, we did a bit of coverage on sort of the struggles between the ongoing battle between the Vancouver School Board and the ministry, and quite interesting to watch. And during that period, Minister McDermid was quite adamant that the VSB was mismanaging their funds, and even some, you know, I spoke to Jane Bowie on the Vancouver School Board, and she said to me, you know, I don't mind if we have to run a deficit if it means that we can keep schools open and you know, keep providing education a level that we can stand behind and feel good about. So I'm curious maybe if you have any feelings or comments on that relationship and where that's at right now.
Well, I think that the Vancouver School Board, obviously, they're not allowed to run a deficit.
Right.
They'll be removed if, or they could be removed if they had run a deficit. So right now, I think they're painted into a corner. They're releasing their updated list of schools that possibly will close this evening, and I don't believe that the school board itself wants to close any schools because while some schools on that list were underpopulated by definition. Underpopulated in 2009. There are other things going on in schools as well. Schools, they also support English as second language classes for parents. Some of them have preschools or other community center things. They're the centers of the community that they're in. And while kids might not be, it might not be full now, in 5 years it could be full again. So I think the school board is faced with the inevitable fact that they will have to close some schools, but they really don't want to.
Any articles that you're working on, stories you're working on right now that you can give us a preview or whet our appetite?
What I'm working on right now actually has a bit to do with that. What happens to, or what we could do with school buildings should they be threatened with closure? Say a school only has a 50% population, well, are there other things from the community that we could move in there, like community centers or health clinics or prenatal classes and things like that. And there are some school districts in the province that have done that already, have taken their schools and turned them into community hubs where they have libraries or seniors clubs in one end and they have schools in the other end. And it helps with costs. And at the same time, if the population should rise later, they can always move those services out so the more kids can move in. So it's a way of looking at keeping the buildings and making people more involved in the schools as well.
Interesting. Well, we really look forward to that coverage, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk with you when that's published.
Great.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you.
Take care now.
You too. Bye.
And that was Katie Hislop from the Tai'i.ca, the online news magazine published here in BC, reaching all corners of the province and covering all issues in the province. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. This is News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
Government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
A video of the incident was posted on YouTube.
Until now, Canada's internet has been an open network and a level playing field for free speech and innovation. All that is under threat. A handful of companies want to limit what you can access on the internet. In May, SaveOurNet.ca led a successful campaign pushing net neutrality to the top of the Liberal Party website. Now, both the New Democratic Party and the Liberals have official policies supporting net neutrality. In addition to that, the CRTC has recently issued new rules intending to prevent the actions of some internet service providers from limiting certain types of traffic and content on the web. But the battle does not end there. To tell the government that net neutrality is a vital part of our democratic society, and for more information, visit www.saveournet.ca. This message is brought to you by SaveOurNet.ca and CITR 101.9 FM.
I was a prisoner.
I was a prisoner.
Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my dreams. It made me lie. Steal.
Cocaine took my will, my soul.
And all I wanted was more cocaine. Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
1-866-662-8300.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Jess Landing. In national news, representatives from the Canadian Federation of Students, British Columbia, will be in Ottawa this week lobbying members of Parliament and senators for a high-quality and affordable system of post-secondary education in British Columbia and across the country. The CFS nationally represents 500,000 students. The University of British Columbia, Vancouver, is a member of the Canadian Association of Students Association. Nimi Takkar, CFS BC chairperson, says, quote, "A post-secondary education act will help develop education in the same way the Canada Health Act has laid the foundation for world-class healthcare in Canada," end quote. Students are in Ottawa as part of the Canadian Federation of Students 2010 Lobby Week.
Last week, in a landmark ruling, Ontario Superior Court Justice struck down key provisions of Canada's prostitution law and the criminal code, arguing that the provisions endanger the people they are meant to protect. The Canadian government will appeal the decision. And we have the opportunity to have Megan Vis-Dunbar, board member of the BC Civil Liberties Association, on the line to discuss this ruling and the BC CLA's call on BC to abide by the ruling and reform employment law accordingly. Megan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So if you could first just briefly summarize the ruling by the Ontario Justice, that would be great.
Well, the ruling really looks at the provisions of the criminal code that criminalize aspects around prostitution. So things like the body house provision, the communication provision in the criminal code, and struck those down, saying that these provisions in the criminal code are contrary to the charter. Basically, what the judge concluded is that prostitutes and sex workers are faced with having to decide between their liberty interests and security of the person. And in doing so, it's a violation of their charter rights.
Could you explain how exactly the ruling will make the trade and those involved with it safer?
Well, what the judge found is that the legislation and the criminal code really contributes to the harm that sex workers face. So it's pushing them into conditions where they're working later at night in unsafe places such as on dark streets to try and avoid the legal repercussions of the criminal code. And so if adults who are engaging in this on a consensual basis aren't faced with that fear of criminal prosecution, they don't have to go into these unsafe conditions to do their work.
Now, for Canada, and many see Canada as a fairly progressive country, this is, many see this as a landmark decision, something maybe similar to how decisions that have been made in the way that sex workers are maybe seen as a, what am I trying to say? A way to approach this in more of a way of harm reduction rather than criminalization. And so looking at maybe Scandinavian countries and the way they've approached this, do you see this in the same way that other countries who have been quite progressive in this regard have approached it?
It's one step towards reducing some of the stigma and stereotyping around sex work and allowing the government to work towards form of regulation that's going to ensure that the health and safety of sex workers is protected. So it's not a full answer in itself. What it does is it just strikes down those provisions of the criminal code. And what the BCCLA is doing is really calling on the government in BC to now look at how things such as employment law can be reformed so that the health and safety of sex workers is adequately addressed and it's not just left in kind of a legislative void.
How do you think employment law in BC should be changed?
Well, right now, sex workers don't receive any protection as a regular employee would under, say, WorkSafe BC, under different types of employment legislation. There's just nothing. And then on top of having sort of the same standards of workplace safety applied to sex workers, we would also like to see laws specifically catered to sex workers in some way. So trying to guarantee that what you don't end up in is a situation of exploitation where people are essentially forced into a type of work that they don't want to do, but that it's adequately recognized in legislation.
The federal government has said they will appeal this decision. What do you think about that? What do you make of that?
Well, it's a very well-reasoned, very thorough decision. The judge had a lot of evidence before her and went very thoroughly through the law and how it applies to that. So it's certainly our hope that this decision will hold up under appeal. And I don't think there's any doubt that this decision will go all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. And ultimately, the hope would be that we get a ruling from the Supreme Court of Canada striking out these provisions of the criminal code, and then that would apply to other provinces in addition to Ontario.
You probably don't have a crystal ball in front of you, but if this does, as you say, will likely go to the Supreme Court, what do you think the outcome will be?
Well, it's always difficult to say, but certainly my hope is that this decision will be held up at the Supreme Court of Canada.
Interesting. Any other comments on the implications of this in other Canadian provinces and specifically in BC?
As I said, this decision is very well reasoned and there was a large body of evidence before the judge. So I think that governments in other provinces, and including BC, should really take this as a ruling that applies to all Canadians and should abide by that ruling here in BC and other provinces across Canada and start legislating accordingly so that the health and safety of sex workers is protected.
Great. Well, Megan, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us here at News 101, and we will look forward to sort of the, more of the outcomes out of this decision. So we may be talking to you in the future.
Great. Thank you very
much. Great. Thanks so much, Megan. And that was Megan Viz-Dunbar. She is a board member of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association. And again, I just really want to thank her for joining us on the phone here in Vancouver. We're going to take a quick break, but after that, we've got your weekday weather forecast. I wish it was the weekend already, but it is Monday. And then we've got your arts report coming up after that. Stay with us. This is News 101, CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver.
I'm troubled by shapeless fears. Who can live in the modern world without catching his share of them? I hope I've landed on my feet this time.
Need a place to rent? Have a place for rent? AMS Rents Line can help. AMS Rents Line is an easy-to-operate, touch-tone, and web-based system that connects thousands of landlords with UBC students looking for off-campus housing. UBC students can search the ads for free or place a two-week posting for $5. To view current listings, visit www.amsrentsline.com.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Jess Landing.
And I'm Andrew Longhurst, and you're hearing us on the radio on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thanks for being with us. It's 5:27 and time for your weekday weather forecast. For that, we go to Daniel Casanova. Thanks for being with us, Daniel.
Thanks, Andrew. Well, tonight we'll be getting a break in the weather with a couple sunny days ahead due to a large high-pressure ridge that's building to the southwest of us. But after that, unfortunately, we're in for some more gloomy weather. For tonight, we'll have partly cloudy periods with a low of 10 degrees overnight. For Tuesday, we'll have cloudy periods beginning late in the morning, high-level clouds in the evening, high of 17 degrees and a low of 9. On Wednesday, it will be sunny with a high of 19 degrees and a low of 10. For Thursday, it will be cloudy with 40% chance of showers, high of 17, low of 11 degrees. For Friday, expect periods of rain with a high of 16 degrees, low of 12. On Saturday, we'll have rain with a high of 16 degrees, low of 13. And for Sunday, we're going to have rain again with a high of 16 and a low of 13 degrees. Currently, it is 13 degrees and partly cloudy at YVR. The normal temperatures for this time of year are a maximum of 15 degrees and a low of 18. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
Daniel, thanks so much for bringing us that weekday weather forecast. I'm really not looking forward to the rain, but what can I do? Now we're going to go to the arts report prepared by Adam Janusz, the arts reporter and arts director, and host of the Arts Report Wednesdays from 5 to 6. So here's the arts report for Monday, October 4th.
Here is your arts report for October 4th on News 101. The Teeing Is, a strange title for the UBC Visual Arts Faculty Exhibition, which is running until October 9th. And today, at 5:30 p.m., is featuring artist talks. That is to say, the faculty that have put on the show will be speaking to anybody who would like to come and see them. I spoke to one of the faculty and one of the artists, Barry Jones, and he gave me more information. So I'm here with Barry Jones in the gallery of Kerner's, and we are speaking about the Teeing Is. Can you first tell me a little bit about that title?
Well, can I tell you just a brief bit about the gallery?
Please.
This is the department gallery of the Department of Art History, Visual Art, and Theory. It's located in room 211 of Kerner Library. So it's the AVA Gallery for Art History, Visual Art, and Theory. And I'm the faculty director. The title, The Teeing is a title for a show. And this particular show, the first show in the term, is a faculty show. It's a show that all the visual art faculty take part in, the ones who are teaching this term, all the permanent faculty. So it's not a theme-based show. It's a show of the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of show presents a few problems in terms of coming up with a title. So we have a title that we feel is interesting, is curious, is perhaps a little bit provocative, mm-hmm. and allows people to think about and interpret in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
It is purposely set up as if something's missing. So again, this draws your attention to what might be there, mm-hmm. what might not be there, what's missing, what's not missing.
So that word that starts with a T, it's what comes after that T that isn't there.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, an obvious reading of it is the word thing. And thing is one of those mysterious words that could mean many things to different people. I also like the idea that as it reads there, it's ting, and ting to me is a perfect little moment of music or noise. Mm-hmm. I think it suggests other sorts of readings to the word as well. So mm-hmm. It's a title, I think, that draws attention to the poster and perhaps interests people to come and see what this is about.
Mm-hmm. And then people also have a chance to engage with the artists.
Yeah, that's right. Over two different nights. One is passed already, but coming up, this coming Monday, October the 4th, starting at 5:30, probably will last about an hour and a half. Five of the faculty who didn't speak last time, 2 weeks ago, will be speaking briefly, perhaps 15 minutes, about the work on the wall, about their art practice in general, about perhaps the works leading up to doing these works. It's a fairly informal situation attended by other faculty and students, and people can ask questions. Students can ask questions of their professors. And it's a good way for new students, incoming students, graduate students, undergraduate students, to get to know the people who will be teaching them in classes or who are teaching them in classes, and get a chance to look at their work, because we're all practicing artists, and it's a chance for the students to actually see what their profs do.
Great.
And to question them about it. Aha. Put them on the spot.
Put them on the spot.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you.
That was Barry Jones speaking from the AHVA Library Gallery located at Kerner Library, which is 1958 Main Mall. And the artist talk is at 5:30 p.m. today.
And that was the Arts Report from Adam Janusz, and thanks to Adam for preparing that. You can check out and tune in to the Arts Report on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. for a full hour of local arts and culture coverage. Now we go to an interview from earlier today with Thomas Woodley, president of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. I spoke with him about the United Nations Human Rights Council's report on Israel's May 31st flotilla raid. The UN Human Rights Council found Israel's actions in violation of international law. Here's my interview with him. This is Andrew Longhurst for News 101, and I'm on the line with President of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, President Thomas Woodley. Thomas, can you first tell me a little bit about the organization that you represent?
Sure. Well, Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, we call it CJPME. Our mission is to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East and here at home in Canada. So, in fact, we do seek to find ways in which average individuals can be empowered to participate in our democratic processes in Canada and get involved in various activities.
Great.
Yep.
Thank you. Well, and just recently, the United Nations Human Rights Council released the report condemning Israel's actions in the way that they responded to the Gaza-bound flotilla, the Turkish flotilla, heading to Gaza Strip. And maybe you can tell me a little bit about what was detailed in the report and what the Human Rights Council found.
Sure. Well, I will point out that it was more than just a Turkish flotilla, although there was a Turkish ship, which was obviously at the center mm-hmm. of the worst of the incidents. Basically, the report came out, September 22nd, I believe it was, so a little less than 2 weeks ago. And it didn't have a mandate necessarily to make recommendations, but it was a fact-finding mission, and this is what the Human Rights Council will often do, is create a little commission to actually determine what actually happened in a particular situation. So the fact-finding mission sort of clarifies its mandate, what it understood its mandate to be. It talks about its methodology, and then it actually then goes about and does its work. And in this particular case, the fact-finding mission went to Geneva, to Amman, Jordan, to Ankara and Istanbul in Turkey, and interviewed lots of witnesses, eyewitnesses, forensic experts, the coroner types that would look at the dead bodies or the injured bodies. And then based on that, they put together this report, which details, of course, what the 8th flotilla was doing, what Israel had done to prepare for the flotilla, the actual attack itself and what happened, and then the fact-finding mission's assessment of what happened and whether or not there were violations of international law that took place. And in fact, in one sentence, you could summarize the fact that the fact-finding mission found that Israel violated international law on numerous accounts. And overall, in the attack, it was much excessively violent in its use of force against the people on the ships of the Gaza 8 flotilla.
A quote coming out of the report stated that Israel's actions were disproportionate and brutal and violated international law. Some of the statements out of the report and the accounts were quite brutal. Maybe you want to just provide some specific comments on the actions that did take place aboard the flotilla.
Sure. Well, first of all, just in terms of summary, in paragraph 265 of the actual fact-finding mission, the fact-finding mission found evidence of willful killing, basically assassination or execution-style types of things. And there were six cases, actually, where the fact-finding mission determined that there were actually injured passengers on the top deck of the Mavi Marmara that were actually shot while lying there on the deck, injured, sort of execution-style. There was also torture and inhuman treatment. There was the willful causing of great suffering or serious injury, and that occurred not only during the attack but also in the aftermath while the passengers were held in detention and before they were eventually deported. So I think those are some of the worst things that happened. Of course, CJPME, we interviewed Kevin Nish, who was a Canadian that was aboard the Mavi Marmara during the attack, and we actually issued two documents based on our interviews with him. And what he told us was very consistent with what we see in the fact-finding mission's report about there being gunfire from the helicopters actual prior to the boarding of the Mavi Marmara, that there being excessive use and premature use of firearms or unnecessary use of firearms by the Israeli soldiers as the passengers did not have firearms. There's no proof. The fact-finding mission found no proof that any of the passengers had firearms. Not only was this going on the Mavi Marmara, the large Turkish ship, but the fact-finding mission also took the time to actually look at what happened on the other ships. And of course, no one died on the other ships, but in the same way, there was a certain violence, a certain brutality to the way the Israelis approached the boarding of the other ships, and people were unnecessarily burned or bruised or stun grenades were used, various firearms were used, not live ammunition in those cases, but nevertheless unnecessarily violent against the nonviolent resistance that they were being met with. So it wasn't unique just to the Mavi Marmara. It wasn't just a question of, you know, a few soldiers sort of lost their heads. They were actually seemed to be under sort of operating instructions to use this type of force, even though they were only, you know, they were only facing nonviolent resistance.
Now, Israel has flatly rejected the report, calling it biased and partisan. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I guess that's their choice. The fact-finding mission actually tried quite hard to involve the Israelis, and they met with a representative of Israel in Geneva, and they really tried hard to encourage the Israelis to be involved, and through several official formal communications sought the input of the Israelis, but the Israelis refused to recognize the fact-finding mission and refused to participate. However, if you read through the fact-finding, the mission's report, you actually see that they actually leveraged some of the testimony from the internal Israeli investigation. And so to as much a degree as possible, the mission actually leveraged information that had come out of the Israeli investigation. I think Israel's position in this case may be driven by the fact that politically I think given the the weight of the eyewitness reports, I think a lot of us had a sense of some of the violence that had taken place just by the fact that, that people were unarmed people were killed and injured. A large number of them were killed and injured. And I think from Israel's perspective, they could see that, you know, participation in this inquiry would be seen as legitimizing it in some way, and that's the last thing they would want to do.
Does the response from Israel worry you, or do you think this is, you know, more of what we're seeing in maybe especially under under Netanyahu, more of a rightward shift in Israel's domestic and foreign policies? Is it, you know, out of the ordinary?
Shift, but in fact, Israel never participates with these types of inquiries. In fact, when in 2006, when a Canadian peacekeeper was killed in Lebanon, the Canadian forces performed an inquiry and sought the participation of the Israelis. And the Israelis participated in only a very cursory way, that the Canadian forces were not able to interview any of the Israelis that had been involved in the attack on the peacekeeping shelter. And it's just, Israel just never participates in this. So it's not particularly, I think, a question of the current Netanyahu government. Mm-hmm. But just Israel consistently refuses to participate in international inquiries regarding these violent incidents.
Now, what about their own investigation that the Israeli Defense Forces undertook? Is there, you know, any merit to that investigation?
Well, my understanding actually is that there's more than one. Mm-hmm. One has been conducted, and some results have been released over the summer, and another, I think the results are still to be released.
Right.
These inquiries, and again, this is something that often happens, has happened on numerous occasions in the past, where Israel will conduct its own examination of various things, and human rights organizations that look at the results or look at the conduct of these investigations consistently say that the investigations are not sufficiently credible. There's not access to the appropriate people, there's not sufficient corroboration of testimony, and that sort of thing. You know, for instance, I just recently the New York Times ran an article about two Israeli soldiers who seemed to be indicted by the Israeli government for using a 9-year-old child as a human shield during the Israel's assault on Gaza in 2009. And yet, this is the only indictment so far for using a human shield during that conflict. And human rights organizations point out that there are 9 other cases that they have identified where Israel used human shields, and not one of those cases is being investigated by the Israelis currently. So this sort of tends to be the pattern where Israel, you know, ignores certain case examples or scenarios that are put forth by human rights organizations saying, well, what about this case and what about this case? Mm-hmm. They find alternative ones, and consistently across the board, the number of accusations is far reduced versus those that are put forth by the human rights organization. So there is sort of a pattern of downplaying, of limiting the scope, of limiting the investigation, and that sort of thing. For instance, you know, in these cases, you know, in the Israeli investigation, did they have any eyewitnesses from the did they have any Turkish eyewitnesses or any eyewitnesses? Did any eyewitnesses testify from the flotilla itself? You know,
mm-hmm.
it's those types of questions that would come up. I mean, I haven't actually read a critique of the Israel's investigation that was released over the summer, but I remember human rights organizations saying at the time that it lacked the credibility and breadth that you would expect to see for this type of investigation.
Now, so many of these issues in the Middle East seem very distant from the Canadian reality, and I want to ask you, to what extent are these issues significant, and why should Canadians care at a real fundamental level?
Yeah. Well, I think Martin Luther King Jr. had a great quote on this. He said, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." And I think this is true not just in the Middle East, but in other parts of the world where there are injustices that are taking place. Eventually, if that's allowed to continue long enough to grow big enough, eventually it does start impacting other things that go on in the world. And I think we see some of this in the international geopolitics that surround the Middle East, that people really sort of skirt the real issues and people fight shadow issues or sort of do a type of shadow boxing around the real issues, and I think Canadians should be concerned, because eventually what goes on in the Middle East will color perceptions of people in the Middle East, color perceptions of people of Middle East origin here in Canada, and so I think we need to be careful that we get clear coverage, clear understanding, a clear accounting of what is going on in the Middle East, and that injustices be addressed. I think CJPME as an organization, we stand up. We are, sometimes people accuse us of being a pro-Palestinian organization, but actually we're pro-human rights. We're pro-international law, and part of our role is actually to criticize all violations of international law, and we do that. We do criticize Hamas, and we do criticize Hezbollah for the violations of international law that they commit, but far and away, you know, Israel's violations of international law, you know, those of Hamas and Hezbollah in such a way that we need to, you know, make sure that we understand that and be critical and hold everyone to a common standard as Canadians.
I want to ask you, there's an issue of scope here. I mean, a lot of what we're seeing in the Palestinian territories and the occupied territories is it's a dramatic display of... of, you know, as Jimmy Carter is called, it's apartheid. Is there an issue of scope? And of course, it's important to be critical of and, you know, talk about human rights abuses no matter where it's originating from. But does Israel skate sometimes by too easily?
Well, you know, I think they do have a lot of support from various quarters of the international community. I think quite often when people talk about abuses on the part of Israel, Israel will say, well, what about Sudan and Darfur, and what about this other part of the world? And at some level, they're right, is that there should be attention to all those areas. But to your point, I think, Andrew, there needs to be, you know, we need to address all of these concerns at a root level. And in fact, I won't say that Israel's injustices against the Palestinians approach the number of casualties that we've seen in other conflicts around the world, but they're ongoing. They've been going on for decades and decades, and you know, in as much as Palestinians do sometimes use violent resistance and use violence in their resistance against the Israelis, the Israeli, for instance, the Operation Cast Lead, the Israelis killed at a minimum 1,300 Palestinians, and the Israelis only lost 13 lives. And several of those were from friendly fire. So there's a huge disparity between the actual impact and the actual, you know, casualties on each side in these types of conflicts. And so, in as much as yes, there were violations on both sides, the violations on the part of the Israelis, you know, are hundreds of times greater than those on of their adversaries.
Now, lastly, before I let you go, I want to ask you. The UN Human Rights Council stopped short of calling for a criminal investigation. Is this something that needs to happen?
You know, I think there's plenty of other stuff out there that I think can be pursued more aggressively. I mean, I think they certainly can, but I think in as much as this was like a mini Operation Cast Lead, where it's sort of disproportionate force, unnecessary casualties, I think Operation Cast Lead, you know, and it's the condemnation of that by the Goldstone report, really, I think, is where the international community should focus its attention in terms of trying to bring to justice some of the key perpetrators. I think if the international community is able to do that, and I think that could set a precedent in terms of, you know what, we've just really got to expect all parties in the Middle East to respect international law, especially in the conduct of occupation and warlike activities. So, you know, in answer to your question, you know, I think there are opportunities for pursuit in terms of of war crimes in both cases, but I think the evidence is just so broad and so numerous there in the Gaza attack in 2009 that I think that might be a better strategy at this point.
Okay, well, Thomas, I really appreciate you taking the time to join me.
My pleasure, Andrew.
Okay, take care now.
Take care.
Bye-bye. And again, you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And that was an interview from earlier this afternoon with Thomas Woodley, president of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. And I was speaking to him about the United Nations Human Rights Council's recent report condemning Israel's actions in the May 31st flotilla raid off of the coast of Israel and off the coast of Gaza.
And that's our program for October 4th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITR News. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Jess Landing.
And I'm Andrew Longhurst.
From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Career Fast Track at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.